like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I...
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And if you can't get enough Reynolds, just go to ReynoldsReveal.com and you will go to the archives to listen to, well, I think we've got a very good library of programs. And I've got three guests on the line. First we have John Lear, who once held 17 aviation world speed records, including the shortest time around the world in a Learjet. He's got 20,000 hours of flight time in multi-engine jets. He is a founding member of PilotsFor911Truth.com. Welcome back, John Lear.
Thank you, Morgan.
And then we have from the UK two sharp analysts. We have Andrew Johnson. I call him the voice of reason from the UK. Visit his site, checktheevidence.com. Welcome back, Andrew.
Great to be here with you and John and our next guest, Morgan. Thank you for inviting me.
And finally, we have Richard D. Hall, who is a TV talk show host in the UK. He's a researcher, and I'd call him a citizen investigator. Visit his site, richplanet.net. Welcome back, Rich.
Thanks for having me back on the show, Morgan.
Let's go to, before we go to our World Trade Center analysis of planes, no planes, let's talk about the plane, the airliner in the news, and I'm going to ask John Lear for his comments first, and then Andrew and Rich. We have the news reports about Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, which is a Boeing 777, lost allegedly on March 8, 18 days ago. The news accounts include the following alleged facts. There was a longtime anonymous associate of the captain of that flight, Captain Zahiri Ahmad Shah, who claims that Shah was terribly upset when his wife told him she was leaving him. And then there are claimed to be altitudes as high as 45,000 feet, as low as 12,000 feet. So I'm wondering, well, aren't they some system or other tracking that to get that kind of data? And then there's a New Zealand aviation expert, Peter Clark, claiming, quote, this had to be a pilot or somebody with expert knowledge. The co-pilot would not have had the capability of doing this. It's a takeover of the aircraft. It can only be the pilot, unquote. That seems interesting about 9/11. And then we've got a headline, families demand proof of crash. That's from the UK Telegraph. And yet, where are the families demanding proof of a crash of the survivors of the alleged victims of 9/11 plane crashes? And then we have butchering that pronunciation, but a British telecommunications company with satellite data about the location being reported. There's no confirmed wreckage from the plane about 1,500 miles west of Perth, Australia. Allegedly flew on 7 hours after it vanished from radar. Chinese government order demands release all satellite data if you use to conclude that the plane was lost. And I wonder about satellite data for pictures of the four alleged airliners of 9/11. 7 hourly pings on the Malaysian flight were used to pinpoint the final location over the Indian Ocean. The last time I looked, they narrowed it to an area twice the size of France, 469,000 nautical square miles. Satellite images pick up 122 potential objects, images supplied by the French-based aeronautical firm, to be exact, Airbus Defense, and the objects are approximately 1,588 miles west of Perth. I'm almost done with my headlines. Information released, this information was released by the Malaysian government, and here's a statement by one Steve Wong, who is a relative of a passenger aboard the flight in Beijing where they had a protest. And he said, Wong said, they, meaning the Malaysian authorities, have no respect for us, no respect at all. They promised a full briefing at 10 a.m., but they did not come. We want the truth, unquote. So I turned to John Lear to get his comments on this whole lost airliner situation.
Well, Morgan, as I said, when all of this started, 8 hours after they made the turn, somebody knew where it was, but I didn't. Now, the way I deduced that somebody knew where it was is because on that airplane, there's many devices that send back to both Malaysian Airlines, Boeing aircraft, and Rolls-Royce, who made the engines, exactly where that airplane is, whether the engines are turning or not, and a whole bunch of other data. That stuff is sent back to those companies, and it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop even if the circuit breakers are pulled in the cockpit, for the main reason that those people responsible for that airplane and those engines want to know exactly what's going on and where they are. They're not going to put their company future on whether a pilot is going to pull a set of circuit breakers or not. So 8 hours after they made the left turn or turn to the west, that was what would have been when they ran out of fuel. That is where somebody knew where it was. Now, we haven't heard any official statements from Rolls-Royce, who know exactly where it is, or the Boeing company, who know exactly where it is. And I think that a lot of this might be, at least the Boeing part, might be part of the anti-terrorist act, where they don't want it known that they know what's going on at all times, for the reason that they want to keep that secret, should they need to use that information at some time. As far as Rolls-Royce, you never know what they want, but they never made any statement on this, to my knowledge, but they do know where it is.
Yeah, these guys are really bought up. They're so dependent on government actions and inaction. What would you like to add, Andrew?
Well, I think essentially I agree with John, and I'd actually heard from somebody separate exactly the same thing as John just said. So somebody knows where this plane is. Also, I think probably a couple of things to add. The NSA would know where the plane was, exactly where it was. I've heard headlines today saying that they thought the plane was somewhere else, and it's turning into a game of Where's Waldo. It's just becoming extremely comical that they would not know where this plane was. So I have my deep suspicions that did the plane even exist in the first place, or what really, you know, is the true nature of this plane? Are we being just fed just a whole set of propaganda, which is meant to be getting us into more of a fear paradigm over air travel and extra checks being introduced to sort of somehow, by some ridiculous, implausible method, get to know where these aircraft are going, like tagging each passenger with a GPS receiver before they get on board or something like that. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I could think of a million crazy ideas that they might try to ride onto the back of this. But, yeah, I mean, that's about all I can comment with. We don't have any evidence of where this plane is, and there's far too much speculation going on. Maybe it's a distraction from something else that's been in the news that they wanted to keep quiet, or it's been going on in that region that they wanted to take attention off. I don't know.
Rich Hall.
Yes, I would only add that that I don't have any first-hand data from this event. All I'm relying on is what has been in mainstream media, and I'd remind listeners of what Bill Cooper said, along the lines of, listen to everything, read everything, believe nothing until you can prove it with your own research. And I don't have any opinion on this, because we know that 9/11 was a big lie, and this event could be the same. So I just wait for the dust to settle and see if any good data or evidence comes out in the aftermath. So I don't really have an opinion on it at this point in time.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Let's go on to the main subject of today's show, 9/11 at the World Trade Center in terms of planes and no planes. You've all studied this case closely, and I wanted to begin with five statements that are varying degrees of boldness to see if we all agree that the evidence points conclusively to these five conclusions. I want to give you statements that are really bottom line statements, and then we will discuss various aspects of the evidence and the details. And see, I'd like all three of you to just agree or disagree with these five statements as we go down the line, and then open it up for discussion after we agree or disagree. So agree or disagree with my first statement. We have proof beyond reasonable doubt, despite eyewitness testimony to the contrary, that no planes crashed into either World Trade Center tower on September 11, 2001.
I agree.
Two, the four cleanest airliner crash sites in aviation history occurred on 9/11. The authorities have failed to produce a single plane part with its unique serial number to identify what plane crashed at each site. Agree or disagree, John?
I agree
as well. Yeah,
I've not looked at that evidence of those claims, so I would just abstain on that one.
Okay. Number three, there exists no authentic evidence that America was attacked by foreign hijackers. In fact, no hijacking took place on 9/11. John?
I agree.
Andrew?
Yeah, I would agree with that as well, yeah.
Rich?
Yeah, I agree with that one.
Number four, 9/11 was the key political event of the 21st century, and the plane fraud was critical to falsely smearing the Muslim world and freeing the U.S. government to conduct a series of wars far from America's shores, aided by a complicit British government at an enormous cost in terms of human lives. John?
I agree.
Andrew?
Yep. Agreed.
Rich?
I would agree, but just add that there's a lot of people within a lot of members of parliament who are fooled by the agenda, so they're not complicit. There are people at certain levels who are complicit. So I would agree. But
okay, five, but,
yeah.
Rich and Andrew and John. Five, my last statement to see how much concurrence there is governments, mass media, and the so-called 9/11 truth movement continue to ignore, confuse, and cover up the truth about 9/11, especially the evidence for no plane crashes and the use of directed energy weaponry to totally or partially destroy all seven buildings of the World Trade Center. John?
I agree.
Andrew?
Yeah, I have to agree on that, because that's a lot of what the book I've written is about.
And you agree with your book. This is excellent. And Rich?
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so if I went back to two, Rich had a little bit of he abstained on this question of plane parts and unique serial numbers. So maybe there is, I'm not sure where to go from here, but there is almost unanimous agreement. And these are strong statements. So let's go back to the where these flights originally began. There's a whole, I don't know how we can spend a whole lot of time on that, but there's a bunch of silly stuff that supposedly went for example, Mohammed Atta and one of his sidekicks, you know, had this commuter flight from Maine and just made the American Airlines Flight 11. And it turns out American Airlines Flight 11, as is was the case of 77, the alleged Pentagon plane, weren't in the BTS database. So they officially never flew. The two United planes were in the BTS database. And I think Andrew's very familiar with Elias Davidson's work. It's online. It's also in his relatively new book called Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11. And he proves that there is no authentic evidence in favor of foreign hijackers, Muslim hijackers. And just to make one final comment in that direction, I recall that Condoleezza Rice, the national security advisor in the White House, and Colin Powell, within 2 weeks, were on the news interview programs on Sunday morning, and they both promised a 9/11 white paper to prove the government's case against Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda terrorists, and the government never produced such a report. So they flooded us with 10,000 pages of NIST and all that other monkeyness, but they never made a honest attempt to justify their own conspiracy theory. So this is before we get to the whole physics and the like about the event the morning of 9/11. So John, what kind of reaction do you have to that statement?
Yes, that's what they were doing. What most people don't know is between Gulf War One and Gulf War Two, our submarines launched 5,000 missiles to Iraq to create as much as we could create terrorists, because we needed an excuse to go into the Middle East and take it over.
Yeah, I think I don't know about the facts there, but I think that's a very good point, is that our government needs to, they're having a short trial on in New York City in the U.S. District Court of, and there they've got this guy up there who's supposedly a son-in-law of Osama bin Laden, and he was the PR spokesperson after 9/11. And I don't know what charges they've got, but they've got some patsies and some very resentful people, that's for sure, and probably some real terrorists created along the way. What about all that, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, just to comment on the Elias Davidson research, I think that's quite a good starting point for certain parts of the story, because I think the simple thing that I took out of that thing that he put together was that there is no testimony from any of the ground crew to any of the hijackers getting on any of the flights. You know, and this is the ground crew, the people who are there at the airports and so forth. So they should have seen these people get on if they, you know, can be accused of committing these acts of hijacking and so forth. So that's a key thing that he was able to establish through looking at all the articles that he went through. So that I think is quite important from that perspective. And the other thing I always bring up when this comes up is that if people watch the second Loose Change film, Loose Change 2, there is a 15-minute segment in that, which I've clipped out and put on my YouTube channel, which goes through the plane stories quite well. And I think at the time they didn't intend for it to, you know, support what we call no big Boeings or no planes, you know, which is a bit of a clumsy name for it, actually, but that's what's stuck with it. But if you watch that 15-minute segment, which they then took out of later versions of Loose Change, it goes through in quite some detail what we've been talking about. And I think it's very worthwhile that people who are asking these sorts of questions have a watch of that segment and see what they think of that, as well as what we're going to go on to discuss, hopefully in a while, with Richard's work and so on.
Yes. Yes. Rich, would you add something?
Yes, I can add something to that. When I've been giving presentations trying to show that what was seen was not a Boeing 767, the question which most people ask you afterwards is, well, what happened to the real planes? What happened to the real passengers? This is the question everyone asks. Now, I've not looked at that because I've not been able to get evidence of, you know, from the flight companies, etc. But I can inform you of one thing, and that is that I was in touch with a British travel agent around this time. And now when you board a flight, you go through the gate, and when the last person gets on board the flight, the person at the gate who checks the tickets, they close off that flight. Now, what that does is it alerts worldwide computer databases that the flight can no longer be sold or booked. So it prevents travel agents from booking seats on a flight which is boarded. Yeah. So that's the flag that the system uses all over the world to tell travel agents that you can't sell any more tickets on that flight. This travel agent told me that they checked both Flight 11 and Flight 175. This is after the alleged impacts on the towers, and the travel agent could still book tickets for passengers on those two flights. So what that suggests to me, possibly, is that the flights did not board.
John Lear, you've clarified this issue about, remember, the passenger manifests were variable. They kept adding a couple names and then deleting, and then the airlines would not stand behind the passenger manifest. They'd say, call the FBI. But this should have been routine. So tell us why you know for sure who's on the plane and who isn't, John.
Well, when the flight closes out, the captain signs the weight and balance and the maintenance release and a list of the number of passengers that are on board, because that is part of the weight and balance. That goes in an envelope, which goes out the door, and the door can't be shut unless that envelope is on the other side of the door. Now, we've not heard anything about envelopes in any of the flights, but there should be four envelopes.
When it comes to that big question that your audience often raises, Rich Hall, I can't help but think of Jim Mars, the famous author on a lot of issues, including 9/11, who he would always say, hey, I didn't plan or execute the crime, so I don't have that kind of information.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, John Lear's association, Pilots for 9/11 Truth, has done this study of the ACARS data, this text messaging type service that the airlines use, and found that United Flight 175 that supposedly penetrated the South Tower at 9:03 a.m. on 9/11 was in flight and was all the way out past Indiana based on, I could call it cell towers, but basically the ground messaging receiving stations and broadcasting stations. So tell us a little. I think that's a very important study. Two great studies have come out in the last few years. One of them is Rich Hall's study. We're going to learn about that, more about that. But also this Pilots for 9/11 Truth study that United 175 was far west of the alleged crash point long after 9:03 a.m. John, can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, that's just another proof of the people who pulled this off weren't exactly endowed with a lot of brains. You know, one of the things they missed, not only the speed, I don't know what would possess them to say that airplane or put that data on the flight data sheet that it was going 561 miles an hour. But remember, the other mistake they made is in the Pentagon, when they put the last altitude recorded was 100 feet. The reason they put that is because they figured that any lower than that, that the flight data recorder would not have recorded. But what they failed to realize is that 100 feet is recorded at 29.92 inches of mercury. The reason they do that is because the pressure is varying all over the Earth at all times. So it's impossible to get an exact height for the airplane above the ground because the pressure is always changing. So what they do is they record it at a standard pressure, which is 29.92 inches of mercury. And then after the crash, if they need be, then they can correct that altitude for the local pressure. In the case of the Pentagon, their closest pressure was at the airport, right close to their national airport, and that was 30.22. If you subtract 29.92 from 30.22, you'll get about 390 feet. And so that's how much higher the airplane was above the Pentagon as it's allegedly crashed. And this is only because the perps didn't realize what pressure the flight data recorder recorded at.
And it's also confirmed by the
mistakes they made because they didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah. The data highly likely were real, and it's consistent with the flyover that the Citizens Investigation Team found with all those eyewitnesses, credible eyewitnesses at the Pentagon event. But now you mentioned the speed, John, of the flight 175. Perfect segue for Rich Hall to take 5 minutes or so to explain his 3D modeling about what happened with the whole 175 image.
Yeah.
Rich.
Yes.
Well,
are we going to a break,
Rich,
Morgan?
We're going to go to a break. So we'll bring you back on after the break. You're listening to the Reynolds Reveal, and we are discussing no plane crashes at the World Trade Center on 9/11 with three wonderful guests, three experts.
And one pill makes you small.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. We do welcome callers here at the Guerrilla Media Network. The number, 218-862-9829. My guests today are John Lear, Andrew Johnson, and Rich Hall, the latter two from the UK. And we were at the point in the show where we can discuss or listen to what happened in Rich Hall's marvelous research, and he did some 3D modeling and made some amazing discoveries that I think really advance our knowledge a great deal about Flight 175 at the South Tower. Okay, Rich, tell us what you did.
Yeah, Flight 175, it was the alleged flight which impacted on the South Tower, which was the second impact. Obviously, with it being the second impact, a lot of people were pointing their video cameras at the South Tower. I think just over 50 video cameras captured the event. Now, I watched a film called September Clues by a chap called Simon Schack, and in that film, he examined some of the mainstream media video clips. And one of these clips was the Chopper 4 NBC footage. If you Google that, Chopper 4 NBC, it's sometimes referred to as the ball clip. Now, this, in Simon Schack's film, he was suggesting that the shape and size of whatever the object was wasn't consistent with the plane, and its trajectory was different to the trajectory seen in all other videos. And when you look at this particular clip, the object, it seems to come from an almost vertical trajectory downwards towards the towers. And I was convinced at that time that, yes, this object, whatever it was on a different path to the what was seen to be a plane in the other videos. So I then tried to work out what its 3D path was just based on objects in the foreground and in the background. And I made quite a lot of estimates in that analysis, the initial analysis. And I was challenged by quite a few people who were saying, no, they believed that whatever that object was, its trajectory was the same as the planes or alleged planes in all of the other videos, even though it looked completely different. Now, the only way to verify this, in my mind, was to actually build a computer 3D model of the whole area find out what the official flight path was, plot the official flight path in the model, and then use the model to overlay as many of the video clips that I was able to. Now, I was able to use 26 video clips because not all of the clips show a very long trajectory path, so you can't actually compare it to the radar path. With 26 clips, and what I was able to do, I used a package called Google SketchUp, which you can download free of charge from the Google website. It's a 3D modeling package. It's a very, very good piece of software. You can actually download the 3D model from my website. You go to richplanet.net/911video, and you can have a play around with it. So you can actually position yourself at the World Trade Center complex, and you can move around, you can rotate it, and you can view the situation from any angle. So what I did was I got these 26 videos and I overlaid them with the 3D model, and I was able to show that the paths match the official radar path in every case, even the NBC ball footage. Now, the reason why the NBC ball footage appears to be coming down vertically is because the helicopter, well, I assume it was a helicopter that was filming the towers, is much higher up than all of the other video cameras. So it actually makes it look like a different path, but it's not. So I changed my opinion on this, because I was persuaded initially by Simon Schacht that video fakery possibly had been used. But this led me to change my opinion in that, they would have had to have got 50 video cameras, sequester them somehow, and then insert planes into all of these video clips. And I just think there's far too many for them to be able to have done that. So my conclusion was that an image which looked like an aeroplane was seen in the sky. Now, people will say, well, there you go, it was a plane. Well, no, because the speed is impossible, 580 miles per hour, and also the impact dynamics, which I've looked at very closely in two of the three video clips, show completely impossible impact dynamics. And I think this is where the illusion hasn't worked. When the actual whatever it was is impacting on the side of the towers, the physics are just completely impossible. The wings melt into the building and they should snap off and fall to the ground. There's no deceleration on impact. The whole fuselage just seems to completely melt through solid steel columns, which again is impossible. Sections of the plane would break off and they would hit the ground. We would see this. We didn't see any of that. So I think this might be why they've done it at such a speed, because let's say it was done at under 300 miles per hour, I think the video would have looked even worse. The physics would have been even less convincing than they were. So I think they've done it at a speed that might fool most people. So my conclusion is that something was tricking us. Some people call it a hologram. I don't really use that word. I don't know what it was, but it certainly wasn't a plane, in my opinion. And the two main things are impossible speed and impossible impact dynamics.
Could I ask a question, Rich, about Chopper 4? Is that the piece where you're up high? It is from a chopper or some kind of aircraft. And it does look like it's coming in not a dive, but maybe a 20-degree angle or something. And it's very, I called it almost diaphanous. In other words, the figure, somebody calls in or another reporter says, see that? It's up here and track it. And then the two anchors said, oh, yeah, I do see that. In other words, it didn't have a lot of solidity. It didn't appear like a real plane. Is that the Chopper 4 video?
It is. And the object, whatever it is, has a backdrop of the river and the buildings in the distance. So it doesn't have a blue sky background.
Yeah.
And I think almost all of the other clips this blue sky in the background. So possibly whatever method they've used to create this image in the sky works best with a background which is, you know, a fixed texture rather than river and buildings. So perhaps this is why the Chopper 4 video clip was less convincing than the others. The illusion wasn't as good, perhaps, on a different background.
You know, this work of yours is, to me, very convincing because the image looks different in different videos. You know, it looks like almost a black plane in one of them, and it has an aluminum look in another. And this would account for the fact that the tail section or, you know, rudder stabilizers, they'll disappear and reappear, or even though, you know, almost the entire left wing will not show up. So the imagery, as you conjectured, they had to run it at high speed to make it convincing. And it accounts for the different imagery from different locations and perspectives. I think it's very compelling what you've done. So how about Andrew? Andrew, your thought on this?
Sorry, I thought I was muted there and I wasn't. Sorry. Okay. Richard's done some wonderful work on this analysis, and I recommend that people watch it from his website. And it's vitally important that they understand the details and what is shown. You know, I think it just complements what I researched a few years before with the witness accounts and so on. And Richard was describing there how, you know, the image looks different from different camera angles. And I personally, from speaking to a couple of witnesses, think that accounts for their, you know, changing stories. They're not seeing things, you know, the same from different locations. That is my own personal sort of conclusion that I've drawn from reading some of those witness accounts. And
Andrew, I did a review of this one book where they had some 70 witnesses, some of whom were in a position to see a plane. And one of them, I thought, made the best comment. He was an NYPD officer. I think he was with the scuba diving team, but he was in a helicopter, and this plane image actually flew under them. I guess he was over there on over the Hudson River on the west side of downtown, and he watched this image go into the building, and then there was this big Hollywood like ball of fire and Independence Day explosion, and he said it looked like an evil magician's trick. So here again, it didn't look quite real, but and I wonder about Evan Fairbanks. Remember, he had this close-up shot kind of at the base of the building, and you only see the plane is only in a few frames, and then it's swallowed up by the South Tower. And he does an interview with Peter Jennings, I believe, of ABC News. And he says, you know, we've been trained to see these things by Hollywood, and it didn't look real, and this didn't look real, but it was real. And in other words, I'm thinking this guy is not part of the plot. He's trying to make as good a sense as he can of what is on the video. Your comment, John. John Lear. We still have John on the line, Pete. Okay, is Morgan on the show?
Yeah, I can hear Morgan.
Okay, what about Rich? Yeah. Are you still there, Rich?
Yes, I'm still here, yeah.
Okay. Now, maybe we should go on to another bit of, I don't know if we can call it speculation or guesstimating, educated guesses, but I know Rich has offered the idea that maybe the technology involved a missile, a missile like a Tomahawk, which may be a bunker buster. You correct me if I'm wrong, Rich, but this missile would evoke imagery around it in this secret or semi-secret technology. And then it would make a penetration and a bomb would go off. Maybe engineered to have this spectacular visage. And then we have the problem of how you make the wing marks. But what's your thinking about that, Rich?
Okay, well, I suspect that that there was something solid there because we've got two sets of radar data. And I'm assuming the radar data is correct. We've got something traveling much faster than a 767. if it was carried out by the military, then I think it's a fair assumption to make that it was a missile which was cloaked in an image. Now, all I did was I've looked at missiles that typically travel at that speed, and there are quite a few that was in service at that time. One of the most common is a Tomahawk cruise missile, which travels at a nominal speed. I think it's around about 560 miles per hour, which is the order of whatever the object was traveling at on 9/11. So it is speculation, but all I'm doing is I'm taking the speed and I'm saying, well, what else travels at that speed? Now, with regards to the wing holes, I think the footage of Tower 1, the North Tower, where when the first alleged plane is seen to go in, after this event, the cameraman zooms in, and you clearly see that the wing holes appear about 10 or 15 seconds after the impact. It's actually in my video. If you go to richplanet.net/ 9/11 video, it appears that there's somehow holes in the side of the building, the shape of wings, being created after the impact. And people have suggested that this is an energy weapon. Andrew can possibly fill us in on that. Due to certain changes in the Earth's magnetic field measured in Alaska, I believe.
Yeah,
Andrew, your comment?
That's right. I mean, I think particularly with this first hole which appears at 8:46, and, you know, we haven't mentioned Dr. Wood's research into this, which ties in at this point and other points as well, but this I think is one of the key ones, where she has generated from the Alaskan magnetometers this trace, which actually goes right through the events of 9/11, but in particular she has this trace which she showed us a few years ago, and that I think runs from around about 8:20 in the morning to I think about possibly 9:20 or something like that. And it shows a trace where the Earth's magnetic field appears to dip in a certain direction, and the minimum of that dip is at exactly 8:46, and then gradually it recovers again, and I think reaches a sort of maximum point 9:06 when the second alleged impact happened, and then starts to decrease. So this is clear evidence to me that there was some type of effect going on, which was obviously affecting the Earth's magnetic field. And my interpretation of that, rightly or wrongly, is that there was some type of energy buildup going on, and that reached, and then there was just some kind of discharge or something, and maybe that's not quite the right word, which created this hole at 8:46 in the tower. And did they coordinate that with a missile as well to generate the pyrotechnics? And what we essentially saw was some type of energy system which actually created the hole physically, or most of it. And then we had something that, similar to what Richard was describing, actually creating the pyrotechnics in some way. It's possible. I mean, again, that part is speculation. What isn't speculation is that that hole could not have been created by a Boeing plane in the alleged way.
Oh, yeah. It's much easier to disprove or falsify the official story than it is to explain in a compelling way how they did it, how they pulled off these evil magician's tricks. Is John Lear still on the line? Is John with us?
Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. John, maybe we should go. I want you to explain to our listeners why a hijacking, as portrayed by the government, is an impossible event, just from a human point of view. How are you going to take over this plane, and how are you going to run it into this 208-foot-wide building?
Yeah, well, first of all, you have a hijacker who is not going to be more than, say, 5 inches or 5 feet, 6 inches tall going into the cockpit and going to try and take it over. I'm getting a feedback here, Morgan. I can't talk.
Okay. You sound clear to me. Is Pete, we have a audio problem.
We should be good. Are you okay now?
Testing 1, 2, 3. It's a real
feedback. You sound good, John.
Feedback here. Makes it hard to talk.
Let me reconnect real quick. We'll be right with you. Could you give me 30 seconds? Yeah.
Hey, that reminds me of John Lear telling us about the clacker going off. You know, once you exceed VMO, velocity max operating, this clacker would go off, and they discontinued doing that form because apparently they had a crash in which a pilot wasn't thinking straight because of the noise of the clacker. But I hope we get John back.
Were talking about the clacker?
Yeah, because of your feedback was reminding me about the clacker. But go ahead, John.
Okay, well, we have a hijacker going up front, and he's going to try and get these two pilots out of their seats to take over the airplane. It's just inconceivable. How's he going to do it? These guys are strapped in with their seat belts and shoulder harness. So, let's assume he takes his knife and he disables the co-pilot, and then he disables the captain by the only thing he can do is slit their throats. Any other damage is not going to help him get that body out of the seat. So let's say he does that. He slits their throat, gets the carotid artery, and now there's blood all over the place. There's all over the wheel that you control the airplane with, all over the instruments, all over the seat. Now he's got to figure out how to take that fairly complex seat belt off, how to release it. And before he does that, he's got to figure out how to pull the seat back so that he can pull the pilot out, because the way that the pilots are in that seat is they get into it and then either electrically or mechanically pull themselves up so that they're right at the wheel and the instruments and all that. There's no way that anybody could pull a pilot out if that seat is forward. So let's assume he figures out how to pull it, how to pull the seat back, gets a guy out and gets him in the companionway, which is a little bit unbelievable because it's so small in there. But let's say he does, and now he gets into the seat himself, and he's going to fly this thing. Now, here he is up at, 30,000 feet, 90 miles north of New York. And he's going to try and fly this thing. The only thing he's ever flown is a Cessna. Everything in front of him is completely different because of the new high-tech instrument presentation. And you have to press a button to get the different instrumentations. There's four or five displays, but depending on what display the captain had on, he'd have to press the button to get to one that was navigation. It's unlikely that he could ever do this. But let's say he does. Okay, now he's heading towards New York, and he has to figure out how to do the descent. So now he has to figure out how to disconnect the autopilot. And that's fairly complex if you want to disconnect it so that you can fly it. But let's say he does, and now he points the airplane down, and he has to figure out where the World Trade Center is that he's going to crash into. So he's looking out the left side of his airplane, and it's very difficult. I know I couldn't do it, pick it out the first time. But with a little smoke down there on the other one, on the first building, he'd be able to locate it. So he flies down, and somehow he knows that he should be turning by the Colts Neck VOR and headed north. And somehow, now as soon as he starts picking up speed now, the clacker, which is the over airspeed warning, starts going off. This is a clacker that's in a rhythmic place that sounds that the pilot is disoriented and immediately reaches for the throttles to pull him back, because he knows that that's what has to happen. So he's got the clacker going. He's trying to organize the descent. Now he's got to line up with the World Trade Center. He's got the smoke of the North Tower there, so he aims at it, but how he's going to figure out how to keep the airplane so steady that for the last 15 miles it's aimed at a target that's only 208 feet wide, and he hits it within 32 feet of dead center. How he's able to do that, I don't know, because I know that I couldn't do that at the top of my at the peak of my profession, because I would need to do it a couple times to organize take the buildings, one that's 15 miles away, one that's 10 miles away, one that's 5 miles away, to know that I have things lined up and ready to go. But he wouldn't have that advantage. He has to do that the first time. And it's just unbelievable that somebody was able to do that, which he wasn't, because that never happened.
Yeah, it's complete fiction. If we Yes, Rich? Yeah.
Could I get a comment from John about the speed, the alleged impact speed, in terms of how realistic that is? 583 miles per hour, according to my calculation.
561, I've heard you say 580. The figures I've seen is 561 miles per hour, which is, I believe, 480 knots, which is 120 knots over the maximum safe speed of the airplane, which is 360 knots. It's totally impossible. It cannot happen.
It's impossible, right? Flat out. Physically impossible for one of these big bus type aircraft with a 7-foot diameter propeller, basically, within the housing. Yeah. It cannot happen. We've got John Lear, Andrew Johnson, and Rich Hall on the line, and we are talking no planes at the World Trade Center. The government story is totally bogus, and we've got a few leads on how they actually pulled it off. Come on back after the break. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we do welcome callers. 218-862-9829 is the number to speak with our very knowledgeable guests about the no plane crashes happened at the World Trade Center on the morning of 9/11. If you would like to see or hear more of the Reynolds Reveal, just type in reynoldsreveal.com and you will go to the archives. Well, gentlemen, why don't we discuss in our remaining time various topics that we haven't done enough on. And the first one is eyewitness testimony. And Pete's got some things queued up. I guess we're going to, first of all, look at witnesses on the morning of 9/11, downtown Manhattan, who did not see a plane.
It appears that there is more and more fire and smoke enveloping the very top of the building. And as fire crews are descending on this area, it does not appear that there's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I didn't get through a plane go in. That just exploded.
I just saw another plane coming in from the side.
You did. I did. That was out of
yes, and that's
view.
The second explosion. You could see the plane.
I was in B tower. A tower.
What floor were you on?
B1.
What floor?
First one.
What happened? Tell me.
When a big explosion happened, some guy came out. His skin was all off. I helped him out. This is him all over.
There's people jumping out of windows. I've seen at least 14 people jumping out of windows. It's horrific. I can't believe this is happening.
Anything else that you saw? Were you there for the second hit by the plane?
About 10 minutes later, the second building went off.
Did you see it?
Yes, I saw it. It just blew up. A big explosion. People started running. It was just chaos everywhere. Yes, I was right there. I was down in the basement. Came down. All of a sudden, the elevator blew up. Smoke. I dragged a guy out. His skin was hanging off. And I dragged him out, and I helped him out to the ambulance.
Heard the explosion, and then what did you do?
We heard the explosion, and we didn't know if it was a earthquake or whatever. And they came on the PA system and said it was a bomb, but then we heard it was a plane. So then we went back upstairs because we thought everything was okay. And then we didn't see the second plane, but we saw the explosion hit the other tower, and planes just came flying towards us.
And that's when you ran?
That's when we went to the other side of the building and then waited to hear from the PA system, and they said they were evacuating everybody. And then we just walked all the way up Broadway, and glad we did, because the whole building came down.
You can see that there is smoke there coming out of at least two sides of the building.
Now, a large section of the building is blown out around like the 80th floor.
Was it hit by something or was it something
inside?
It was inside.
Because it looked out, everything was coming out.
Everything.
All the windows were coming out, all the papers.
What is on the sidewalk?
I didn't see.
No second fire. It was a bomb. Bombed another building, not second plane. That's a bomb. Who said the second plane?
Down. It looks like it's like the top, I can't even tell you, maybe 20 floors. Intense smoke. It's horrible. I can't even describe it.
Do you have any idea what kind of plane it was?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any idea what hit the World Trade Center?
What it was?
Yeah, what kind of plane? We're getting reports that an airplane hit the building.
I didn't even know that. Honestly, I was walking up and looked up and saw a big boom and fire. You know, I got to tell you, we were all saying around here that it was very interesting that it would be a bomb and it would be so high up. So perhaps it was a plane. We have no talk of a plane. However, I have to tell you, there are still things flying in the air.
Okay, that's the clip that Andrew Johnson offered, at least part of it. Why don't we then go to the Harley guy, who turns out apparently the evidence shows he's an actor, and look at that interview.
Tumbling down. We want to bring in Mark Walsh, who's a freelancer for Fox. You live just a few blocks away and witnessed.
Dude, I live on the 43rd floor of a building, which is five blocks from the World Trade Center itself. I witnessed the entire thing from beginning to end.
People talk about how it looked like a movie. I know when I came walking down here early this morning and saw both towers on fire and people on every street corner, it was like a movie, but you watched the planes hit the towers.
I was watching with my roommate. It was approximately several minutes after the first plane had hit. I saw this plane come out of nowhere and just ream right into the side of the Twin Tower, exploding through the other side. And then I witnessed both towers collapse, one first and then the second, mostly due to structural failure because the fire was just too intense.
That was apparently Mark Humphrey. He's got a name, Mark Walsh, being interviewed by one of his sidekicks on the streets of New York. And he gave the whole official story in such a compact time. I mean, it was 30 seconds or something. And he witnessed, as the only witness I know of who claims, I witnessed everything from beginning to end. Quite remarkable. Well, let's have some comments from Rich Hall on eyewitness testimony to begin with here.
Well, I can't really speak for them. I mean, I focus on the video evidence, and I do think there was trickery involved. Now, one point I would like to make is that they have been protecting their technology, and part of that has been in promoting the idea that it was video fakery, so that these images of planes were inserted after the event. And I do think that that's part of their psychological operation to protect the technology that they do have. Because if you think about it, if they've got technology to make an aeroplane appear in the sky when it's not there, as soon as people know that that technology is real and is convincing, then they will not be able to use that technology ever again. Because every single thing that people see in the sky, they'll have it in the back of their mind, well, is it real or is it not? And this is why I think they have protected their technology by promoting on the internet the idea of video fakery in the no planes camp. But as for shills, you know, it doesn't surprise me that they put several shills out onto the streets of New York, and the CNN and whoever, they know who the shills are and they know who they're going to get the opinions of. So, yeah.
Hey, I was reading Professor Jim Fetzer on this issue, and I think that he takes a liberty with the language video fakery because he believes it covers both CGI and insert technology and actual videos of a plane image that is not a real plane. And he calls them both video fakery, but I think that's abusive and potentially misleading.
Classic model up. Classic model up.
Yes, there you go. Yep.
I think the film September Clues is the reason why it was made was to promote the idea of video fakery. One of the clips in that film is known as the nose out clip, where what Shaq does is he compares the alleged plane's nose before it goes into the towers and it appears to come out the other side of the towers. Now, if you just get some very simple video editing software and try and repeat what Simon Shaq has done in the nose in and nose out, you'll find it's impossible to do what he's done. In other words, he's completely modified the images to make it look like a plane's nose before it goes in and when it comes out. He's massaged it. And you only know that by attempting to do what Simon Shaq has done, which I have done. And so it took me a while to realize that the September Clues film is trying to steer the no planes theory down the video editing path rather than some sort of technology where a plane can appear in the sky when it's not there.
Just to add on to that, if I may.
Professor Clues group is in the evidence destroying business.
Yeah.
In other words, all pictures and all videos, this is how extreme they are fake and have no evidential value. Andrew, I interrupted. Go ahead, Andrew.
No, I just wanted to add and my thanks to Richard and John as well while we're all here, and you, Morgan. But I just on that particular thing that Richard was talking about, you know, I was in close communication with Richard whilst he was developing his analysis, and we discussed it at quite some length. And I had also my own reasons for, you know, basically coming to the same conclusion Richard had about what September Clues was about. And I wrote an article called 9 or 11 Clues About Simon Shaq, and that's on my website where, you know, I go through some of what Richard just said from my perspective and the evidence I collected related to my interaction with Simon Shaq. And that's not his real name, by the way. And I think there's an underlying, you know, very important element of the psychological operation which Simon Shaq has helped to set up. He's had a few followers, like people that go under the name of Hoi Polloi and a few other people. And Jim Fetzer has also stuck his oar into that whole psychological operation and stirred it round with this article that you recently referenced, I think being published, I think it was February the 14th. I haven't read the article, but I looked at the photographs and so on. And it's like he's just got this big pot and stirred everything into it, into this extremely confusing mess. And you're really not going to get a lot out of studying that. That's very clear.
I've got to tell a story here that Dr. Judy Wood and I, years ago when we were puzzling over this, we called Ace Baker, who we didn't know that much about at that time. We thought he was a good, well-intentioned soul. But in the course, we were asking him about his video, or relying on his video expertise. And we suggested along the way that might it be possible to have maybe a missile with what Rich calls a cloaking, an image extroverted from itself. And the conversation went stone cold. There was a complete silence. Like this was a verboten idea. So, you know, that, maybe that tells you something. John Lear, do you have any comments about this issue?
No, sounds all good to me.
Okay.
One thing I'd like to ask John is just with his involvement with pilots for 9/11 Truth and the speed, well, from the official government report is 510 knots on impact. What do the pilots in Pilots of 9/11 Truth think about this speed and how plausible it is, John?
They all know it's totally impossible. I've never heard one pilot who thinks that that an airplane or a 767 could go 510 knots
near sea level. Yeah, at low altitude. Yeah, it's impossible.
So would you be able to tell us, John, what would, if you're flying at such an altitude and you just try and full throttle the plane, just give us a description of what you think would actually happen.
Okay, let's say you're at 700 feet and you pull through full throttle. You're probably going 340 or 50 knots now with the throttles back at 90-95%. So you put them forward, you only have 5% more to go. So that's not going to create any drastic increase in speed. So it's going to take maybe 10 to 15 minutes for that to slowly climb up to the speed. But as it is doing that, it's going to start disintegrating the engine because you're trying to put more air through it than it was designed to accept at sea level. There's three times as much air at sea level as there is at altitude. So there'll be a point there after 360 knots where the you'll still start getting you'll get what they call a it's not a backfire. It's a trying to remember what they call it on jets. Anyway, it'll start exploding and it won't allow you to go any faster.
Would it be a good idea as a challenge to pilots to show us that a 767 can travel at 580 miles an hour at sea level, a challenge for them to show us it happening and for them to get in the plane and do what you've just said? Do you think they'd be any brave enough to do it?
Yeah, I doubt if we get the insurance to do it from an airplane insurer. But, you know, we have to contend with this guy down at Qantas Aviation who's supposedly a electronics technician, and somehow he got into the simulator room and started himself and got at sea level and took it up to, 570 or 80 miles an hour. And, that's just in a simulator. Simulator's not built to simulate over speed like that. It can go as fast as you want, but it's not going to simulate the things that happen with an overspeed. So a lot of this was accepted by people that, oh, well, if a simulator can do it, then certainly the actual airplane could do it, which is not true.
Okay.
Hey, you know, this whole thing seems like a knife-edge discussion where a lot of people insist, oh, yeah, real Boeing 767s crashed into the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Others, including us, say, no, this is an impossible thing. And one of the things that makes this debate go is the lack of debris. You know, to me, it's absurd not to have a single tail section. They're 40 feet tall. They weigh a lot. They're at the end of a long airframe. You know, it's 159 feet or something. A 767 is that long. And out the back is this heavy stuff. And it, we can see with that one Asiana flight that landed badly in San Francisco, how they snap off. They encounter much of anything. They snap off. And we don't have one of those 40-foot tall tail sections at all four events. And this whole Veronica Chapman over in the UK remarked that, yeah, well, they're plane huggers because there's so few parts to show at these crashes. And here's one more thing I put in my federal case, and then we'll go to John's affidavit. Some desire to talk about that. And that is this. In fact, I lost my train of thought. I got obsessed with the affidavit. Oh, I know what it was. in Salvatore Cassano, one of the New York fire chiefs, got to the north side of the North Tower, where supposedly Flight American 11 hit that side of the tower. And he was asked, you'll recall, Andrew, you went through many of those New York Times released interviews.
Indeed, yeah.
And Salvatore Cassano, they asked him, well, did you see plane parts there on Vesey Street on the north side of North Tower? And he said, no, he didn't see any plane parts. Now, that's that people, that cannot be a real plane crash, an aluminum plane running right into this steel concrete tower that is hell strong. So to me, this whole, you know, insistence that real planes ran into these buildings is just laughable. Anybody have a reaction to that?
Yeah, they scooped up all the parts and took them to Mount Weather.
Yeah, is that near Mount Washington in New Hampshire or what?
I'm kidding. There are no plane parts. I mean, there's supposed to be between two of them on the north, on the World Trade Center 1 and 2. I computed there should be 8,000. Let's see. There should
8
be
million or something, 5 million, right?
Parts.
Yeah. Millions of parts.
And they should all be, they'll should be identified with engraving or stamping who approved that part, what the part number is. And there's not been one, not one single part that has been identified like that.
Okay. Our two guests from the UK expressed an interest in John Lear explaining his affidavit, where I represented the United States, similar to Dr. Judy Wood in her case, in calling it scientific fraud against NIST by its contractors in furthering the plane hoax. And they knew better because they've got scientific and engineering talent I don't have, but I can understand Newton's laws of motion. So in furtherance of my case, John submitted an affidavit. So, John, explain what happened there.
Okay. Explain how you got me, how we got together in the first place.
Well, maybe you have a better memory about that than I do. You know, I recall you saying that you hadn't really figured out the 9/11 airplane thing until you ran across my work, which was not solo by any means. You know, Gerard Holmgren was early on, and Rosalie the Web Fairy were. But then we got hooked up together. I don't recall exactly how, but I requested you to submit an affidavit on behalf of my plea before the court.
That's how it happened, and that's what possessed me to go ahead and write something out. And I started to write it, and I took out my book of naval aerodynamics and thought, you know, I ought to be able to easily prove this with these with a few simple rules, aerodynamic rules, that thing couldn't go 561 miles an hour. And I just attacked it from three or four different ways, and it was pretty easy to prove with text. And text and laws. And so I just took it and wrote each one out, what they mean and how they apply to this particular airplane.
And I'm glad to see that's not only on my website, nomoregames.net, but is being picked up on some others, even if they aren't all the most wholesome people in the world. But it's good to have that affidavit spread around on the internet. I think it's to all the
people. Yeah. Now, I forget what the date is on it, but it's got to be, 6 years old?
Well, it's 2007.
I think it's the date on it. It's 2008, I think. And I was just interested, and I wanted to mention it, because it's been circulated on a number of websites very recently, and I just wanted to mention that, A, it's a very important document, but also that it's an example of old news being recycled, and you know, we tried to get this publicized at the time, or certainly I did, and was met with extreme resistance from people in the so-called 9/11 truth community or 9/11 truth movement. and there seemed to be an equal, if not greater, level of resistance to Dr. Wood's Ketam case being discussed. So, you know, we've been discussing these matters now for 6, 7, 8 years almost. So people should be aware of that.
Well, I've been
waiting
to take exception to what I wrote or show where I made an error, and it's been 7 years and nobody has. I've gotten several letters from engineers with Boeing that said that they read it and they agree with what I put there. And those are bona fide engineers from the Boeing Aircraft Company.
You know, Jim Fetcher made a claim that you made an error on the number of engines, because at one point you said three engines, but you were, what the context was that you were talking about four total jet engines on two Boeing 767. So I don't think you made an error there. I think there was a misinterpretation.
Yeah, well, if one engine landed in the street, there would have only been three left on the in the building, right?
Yeah, one out and three in. Yeah. I go back to this. Where's your airplane debris? They had some obviously planted evidence. I mean, the government was into destroying and fabricating and ignoring evidence. All three methods.
Right.
Yeah,
I wanted to extend your thought there about how, in this case, John Lear's affidavit is being gaining a little exposure outside of our narrow circle, which is a good thing. And I'm wondering, do you think that there is a little more receptivity? Is that what we should say, that there's a little more light showing in the darkness here, or
possibly. I mean, I'd like to obviously let Richard speak again in a moment, because I think he had something to say. But it's quite possible that what Richard's been doing recently. Richard had a tour of talks in the UK in February and early March, and I think that possibly may have had some effect on the awareness of the so-called no big Boeings or no planes issue, and that I think is worth bearing in mind. But also with this, you know, the Malaysian flight and planes disappearing, maybe that made people think of the 9/11 plane, you know, accounts again. I'm not sure. And so maybe Richard can add to that.
Okay, Rich,
well,
go ahead.
I do feel that the no planes issue is very sensitive, because in the UK, well, he's living in America now, a guy called Nick Pope, who used to work for the Ministry of Defence and still has ties with the Ministry of Defence. He gave a talk a little while back called No Planers, It's a No-Brainer. So why is this former MOD guy feel he has the need to debunk the no-plane theories? If it's in the realms of fantasy, why is a former Ministry of Defence man think he has to debunk it? I would also point people to Wikipedia pages, because I know that Andrew Johnson has written about Judy Wood's battle to get proper representation on Wikipedia. And I also believe that John Lear was taken off Wikipedia. So, you know, between the no-planer camp, there's not much representation on Wikipedia. I know that, Morgan, you have a Wikipedia page, and it does mention the no planes. Perhaps we can comment on that.
The thing that amused me about the Wikipedia entry, and I never tried to alter them, because I understand that only establishment points of view really are allowed, but they ignored the fact that for much of my career, I was a professor of economics at Texas A&M University. They suppressed that. I said, right, this is mainly how I made a living and I enjoyed being a professor, but I said, boy, oh boy, they didn't want any hint of prestige attached to my name or that entry, it seemed to me.
I'd like to get a comment from John on his Wikipedia entry. What happened there?
Yeah, it's interesting. I went back to find out what the basis was, and they said the basis of not entering is the fact that even though I held a world record, it belonged to the Learjet corporation and not to me. That was all they said.
You know, I talked to one of John's friends who is quite a pilot by reputation, who lives in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and he had nothing but praise about John Lear. He was just a natural born talent as a pilot. So, it's funny how they try to denigrate people who hold, what should we say, subversive views or views out of step with the government and the mass media. It's just silly.
Perhaps it's just people who are telling the truth that they suppress.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, any other? I'm feeling like we did a pretty good job here, and I enjoyed Andrew's remark about old news. But it just does pay us to replow this ground, I think, because of underexposure, suppression elsewhere, or ridicule. Mm. And we just have to reach out and try and make the facts and the truth of this thing known. And I think we've done that today.
I think when the day arrives that the technology that was used regarding the planes, the fakery that was used, once that technology gets viewed by the public, then I think there will be a realization of how it was done. And it will be interesting if and when that technology does get into the public domain.
Yeah, that would be a great break. Those are two critical problems of getting at this truth. One is an exotic weapon, secret or semi-secret, was used to destroy the World Trade Center. And the other was that a secret or semi-secret technology was used to simulate and defraud the public on the plane crashes. So we've got to overcome those. And thank you very much, gentlemen. John Lear, Andrew Johnson, and Rich Hall from the UK, the latter from the UK. You're listening to The Reynolds Reveal, and I appreciate you all for listening. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, gentlemen. Talk to you later.
Thank you.
All right.